This is Games as a Podcast. Okay. Today, we are very pleased to be joined by Katina Noonan. We both worked with Katina at Sega, where she was a designer for Three Ring Studio. She's been in mobile games for some time now and has worked for some very high-profile titles over the years. Katina, good to see you. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, thank you. Hello, everyone. This is my first podcast. Hopefully it goes smoothly. I'm Katina Noonan, and I've been a game designer for over 15 years at this point. I have experience in casual and hard games in the mobile space primarily. Some of the games that you might be familiar with are things like Modern War, Kingdom Age, Game of War, Final Fantasy XV, A New Empire, Candy Blast Mania, and Castle Story. As a gamer, like, I really enjoy the action-adventure space. I really like quirky, fun, story-based things like Fable 2, which hasn't been as much released recently. And Monster Hunter is, like, one of my favorite franchises in general. So, yeah.
So I was so happy to hear Katina was willing to jump onto the podcast because I always had so many great conversations with her at Sega. I learned quickly that she liked many of the games that I liked, but she was better at them than me. So she helped me understand how to improve.
I don't know if I'd say better, but maybe spend more time in.
Fair enough, yes.
Very cool. Yeah, great to have you again and look forward to the conversation ahead. What we were planning to talk about today, certainly we might digress, but overall we want to talk a little bit about empathy in games and gaming. And maybe in today's world, we need to be talking about it more than ever. First off, I'd like to talk a little bit about kind of community, building communities in games and the importance of kind of listening and understanding your audience, as well as just the importance and value of just diversity, considering other types of viewpoints and understanding that there may be different types of people that are interested in playing your games and addressing that in your designs and in the way you go about thinking about and building games. So obviously the games business is huge. There really is something for everyone. It's a mass market medium now. Gamers come in all shapes, sizes, colors, genders. And I think that there's real power in finding ways to connect with your players in a meaningful way. I have been around the block. When I was growing up, gaming is not something that we really discussed at school. It was me and my friends in the basement. We knew that it was not something that was mainstream, so we didn't talk about it at school. Today, the most popular kid in class might be that way because she excels at Fortnite. It really is a mass market medium. Everyone plays games. Maybe that's hyperbolic. Almost everyone plays games, even if they don't necessarily consider themselves a gamer. And unfortunately, in some dark circles of the internet, games are considered to be the domain and almost exclusive domain of a certain demographic. I believe them to be a very vocal minority. However, they're a very noisy minority, and they oftentimes squelch meaningful conversations about games. Toxicity in games is nothing new. Toxicity on the internet is nothing new. You know, we can certainly dive pretty deeply on that, but I do think now more than ever, it's more important to speak up for those who might otherwise stay silent. Not just because it's the right thing to do, but again, I really believe that different viewpoints makes things far more interesting, just conversationally, from a product perspective, and from a strength perspective. I think the best ideas are ones that are kind of burnished by group discussion. That's what I've always found in my career anyways. So I'd like to talk a little bit about some ideas about how we as game creators can foster a more positive environment for gamers of all types. Community building is super important for games. I'd argue it's important for society. I really welcome Katina's viewpoint, Ethan, your viewpoint, of course, on this. I think it's something that's important.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to add is it's communities, yes, but also artists being able to express openly their thoughts and feelings on representation. And, you know, I think back to when the director Robert Rodriguez was making Spy Kids. He explained that the reason he made those movies was because when he was a kid, there were no movies that he could look to where Hispanic kids were the heroes. And he wanted his own kids and other Hispanic kids to have that feeling, to see that they could be the center stage characters, that they could save the day. And so he was doing it, yes, because he wanted to make a great entertainment that people would love, but he also really wanted to make a platform for people to see Hispanic actors as heroes, which I think it is important. And I think we have people in the games industry trying to do the same, and I think that that's critical.
I also think games have a unique point of view, like books do, where you are another person. So you can build empathy from a way that you might not have been able to previously. Like, this is one of the reasons I love sci-fi, is that it provides a new framework for you to process things where you're not bombarded in real life and can really think about it, like, away from yourself as a person and how you respond to it. So that's one thing that I think that games are really good at doing, is like that empathy, like that kind of scenario, and having a voice to showcase these like subtle, like either microaggressions or things that you might not have considered in your life because you don't experience them.
Yeah, it's an opportunity to experience someone's perspective through literally through their eyes, through the lens, or through their interaction. Going back to sci-fi, Star Trek, I think, is the most obvious example of being very ahead of its time in terms of looking and considering and respecting other people's perspectives. Of course, it's through the lens of aliens, but at the end of, well, not just aliens, but also crew members, I guess. I think that that was very groundbreaking in many ways, and really hope that we see more of those kinds of experiences in games and entertainment at large.
I think also you can see game makers expressing the things they're going through in life through their work. When you look at The Last of Us, when you look at the recent God of War games, some people just became dads. That's pretty clear, right? Because so many of those games, that's the core relationship. And I bet you anything, they wouldn't have been interested in making those games 10 years earlier. But it's nice that whether you're a dad or not, they give you that feeling of what it's like to sacrifice everything for your child. Right. And so if you're a 14-year-old boy and you're playing the game, you haven't had that experience yet, but you can understand deeply what that's like and relate to Joel. And of course, if you are a dad, it's even more powerful. But again, it's a very specific part of human experience that they're trying to capture there. And certainly that very traditional life experience is not the only one you should capture. It's, you know, I liked very much the idea that playing Dragon Age: The Veilguard, one of the lead designers of that game was a transgender designer, and they provided the options in the game to be a transgender character. And they had a character where a whole subplot was focused on learning how to be respectful of that person's pronouns. And I thought that was great, because it's a very light way to make real in a game something that people will experience at school and at work and at other places, and learn how to be understanding and respectful and empathetic by trying it out in a game first, and understanding how to work with new people and treat them as you would treat anyone else. And I personally like seeing that in games a lot.
I think that that character was voiced by Erika Ishii. They're from Dropout. And it's been very interesting seeing their transition in terms of their pronouns, because they've been doing Dimension 20, which is a D&D online thing, kind of like Critical Role, and they've kind of explored their characters in different universes. So it was like so exciting to see that, and kind of like that feeling and knowing the backstory behind that as well was like very exciting to hear.
I would imagine also that if you are a transgender person and you play that game, you'll feel more seen. You'll feel more understood. And this is a story that is meant for you as well as everyone else. And I think that that is great. I think that you don't see that kind of thing enough. And it's a stretch for EA to do that now. It's a very proactive thing for them to do. But I was so happy to see them do it.
One thing that's fascinating about games in general is how many people realize that they're trans, or realize that they are a particular way because they're able to experience it in a game in a way that they haven't been able to experience in real life, as like an aha moment. Like a lot of people, like in MMOs, early MMOs, they would play, they had the option of playing gender, they would, you know, skew one way, and then 10 years later, you hear that they're transitioning, you're like, oh, I see. So like they got a chance to showcase that in a safe environment and kind of feel and explore who they were.
And it's important just in storytelling in general, right? To be able to tell the stories of different types of characters. Some of the most important and interesting stories we have in film and literature are about people very different than ourselves, to your point, Katine. And I think that helps us understand those different points of view.
Yeah, I think the big thing that it does, kind of going back to the topic of empathy, is showcasing that even though people are so extremely different than you are, they are going through the same type of things that you are. It might be slightly different, but like you can personify them to use a word that probably doesn't exist, but you can see them as a person. And once you start seeing someone as a person that's different than you start realizing the similarities versus the differences.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Especially as pertains to storytelling. There's a handful of common storytelling arcs, and to see different people of different perspectives, different backgrounds going through stories that you've heard before, I think can have meaningful impact on the way you interact with others or consider others going forward. I really see a lot of value in finding and uplifting those voices. And I think it's a creative medium, so creativity should be allowed to flourish. And I find a hard time sympathizing with people who recoil at the thought that they can't play as a character that looks just like them. I don't identify as a fat Italian plumber, but I still love to play Mario. So I find the arguments against that we often see to be somewhat inauthentic in terms of not talking about what they're actually trying to talk about, if that makes sense.
Lara Croft is one of the best action characters there is, and I'm as happy playing as her as I am Nathan Drake.
Yeah, what I would say is that it shouldn't matter, right? Because if you want to play as someone, you can choose your character customization and you can make whatever you would like. But like, I really like the phrase, don't yuck someone's yum. Just because you don't want to play as this person and you have the option, like, what does it hurt you to have them be able to see themselves?
Exactly.
Because like, you were talking about growing up and games were kind of the underbelly of like the school. When I was growing up, games were a lot more mainstream. It was like the later 90s, so like NES, Super Nintendo, all those were pretty popular. But it was definitely a boys' club. And I got the, oh, this is a boys' thing, even though I was playing these games, obviously, and really enjoying them. So it's been interesting to kind of see like the shifts from like, you know, Fable is one of my favorite franchises. The first one you couldn't play as a woman avatar. And then like the next one you could. So it's like so great seeing like, oh, I can be more of myself in this particular game.
Well, it's interesting to look at Nintendo as well, where when you're talking about the NES, they were clearly positioning the Nintendo Entertainment System as a toy for boys. All the advertising strictly reinforced that. But by the time you got to Wii, and you had the Japanese men that came to the doorstep of you know, a family and said, "We would like to play," and you saw the whole family, including the mom and the daughter, playing and having a good time, that with Wii and DS, they had moved well away from the idea that it was toys for boys, and they were very excited to embrace the idea of toys for everyone.
Yeah, why not expand your market?
Exactly.
Right.
It makes no sense to be so narrow-minded and focused. Certainly there are people who have made a lot of money with knowing their target demo and being very laser focused on it, but again, games is a mass market medium, and there are so many different types of people that love to play these types of experiences. Why limit yourself if you can come up with a design that can incorporate and delight as many of those people as possible?
Well, I think part of the challenge can be metrics sometimes. I remember when I was at a video game magazine at Ziff Davis called Game Now. Great magazine, had a great time making it, but we got stats back that showed that roughly 97% of our audience was male. And so when there were then games like Beyond Good and Evil that were more targeting a female audience, there was sometimes pushback on giving that a double page spread because it's like, well, 97% of our audience is less likely to be excited about playing as this female photographer. And we'd get even more pushback if the managing editor, who is a woman, a great friend of mine named Carrie, when she wanted to take a female spin on it deliberately, saying that it's great to be able to identify with a female character as a female gamer. These are the types of stories that they really objected to us trying to publish. We did publish them, and I was really proud of our editorial staff for making that happen, but not without resistance, because there
Sure.
was just this very numbers base, that's not your audience. Don't use that precious space for something that most of your audience won't care about. But I think it's important to grow the audience so that maybe next time it's 10% of the audience is women
Exactly.
instead of 3%.
It becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Okay, 97% of these people are looking at it, so we should only serve content. And of course, I mean, no surprise, if you cater to those people, that's all you're going to get. So.
Yep.
Thing that I would point out on this subject is like, in something I fought my entire career about is assumptions based on what people want, right? Beyond Good and Evil.
Yes.
A lot of guys that I know love that game. Like Eternal Darkness
yep.
is another one that has a mostly female character lead.
Yep.
But it also has like some other interesting stories. A great game, by the way, on GameCube. A very underrated one. But there are a lot of these games that are like, oh, guys don't want to play this game. And then you find out like, oh, they do. Like so many men that would play hardcore games would also play a lot of casual games like Bejeweled or all these other things.
Right.
And the opposite.
Well, and it goes.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say exactly what you're going to say is the opposite. Like my daughter, her true love is Zelda Breath of the Wild, and she loves playing as Link. She doesn't care.
Yeah. I'm a little sad to see the direction the Zelda games have taken, actually. I love the world that they've created, but I really miss like that grandiose story and also puzzle mechanics, which they made it more mainstream, and I understand why they did it. But it doesn't have that same sort of in-depth feel and strategy to it, I think.
It doesn't feel like Zelda to you?
No, it doesn't.
That's interesting. I can understand that. I think I'm like somebody who likes novelty and really wants to see changes. At the same time, there is a comfort that I did miss of having the big boss battles and the huge dungeons and the, you know, you get this item specifically for this dungeon. It always felt very rewarding. And they did do away with all of that. So it's a kind of stripping away those things that made the game feel like my comfort food was tricky.
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of ways that you can make things a lot different, but also the same, right? Because that formula was like big dungeons, like lots of puzzles, versus the new Zelda is like little mini puzzles with multiple ways to solve it and multiple strategies that you can use, which is creative. But it also didn't have like that really great story, I feel. Like it had an all right story. But I think the world building is kind of where they went crazy on those games.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and again, I think that Nintendo, broadly speaking, represents a company that's interested in making games for everyone. And to Chris's point, like anyone can identify with being a fat plumber because no one is a fat plumber. I mean, maybe there's a particularly strong interest in that very narrow category of players. But, you know, I think that by and large, the point is like we can just find fun in identifying with a charismatic leading character that has a simple but meaningful goal to achieve. And one thing I love about Nintendo is that their whole model is more about creating a toy. Like Super Mario Galaxy 2 or Mario Odyssey, these are not trying to be films. They're literally trying to be toys that you explore and play with and understand the mechanics and find joy from that. They aren't trying to make anything other than something that would delight them as children. And that delights me as an adult.
Katina, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
When you go about your game design ideation, what's your approach to absorbing or consulting with a community and working either with them or extracting what you can from them to inform your game design?
This is a very, very interesting and in-depth question, to be honest. There's so many facets to this because I've worked on, you know, casual games. I've worked on mid-core games. I've worked on games across multiple different types of genres. And at the end of the day, I'm making a game for them. Like, I might not like that game, I might not be interested in that game, but I am trying to give them this experience that they're looking for. And there are a lot of ways that you can approach this. You can do focus testing, you can look at forums, you can do a lot of interactions with the users. There's some slippery slopes to this because people don't know what they don't know. So, for example, there might be something that they would be really excited about, but it doesn't exist yet. Or they might say something, oh, this is really dumb and I don't like it, but it's how you're showcasing it. I always like this example because, like, WoW releases feature back in the day where it's at a certain point, you stop getting rewards. So it's like you log in and you have full bonuses, and then after an hour, you don't have them anymore. And everyone hated it. And they rebranded it so, hey, you get a bonus hour. And then things go back to normal. So it's the concept of rewarding players for behavior versus punishing for them. And I always skew towards the rewarding players for their behavior. And you can see this in a lot of old school games where it's like, oh, you lost and you lost all your gear. And there are definitely audiences for that. But overall, people don't necessarily have as much time as they used to. And it's more fast paced. So making sure that it feels good when they come back. Because if you die in mobile or like a free to play game, you want people to enjoy it and want to come back. So you need like that rewarding experience. Like you said, just kind of wrapping that all up, having a North Star for what you're looking to create for the player, what is an industry leader in the market, what people really enjoy, what they don't enjoy. And if you're trying to make something new, finding that annoying point. So everyone has it. So if you talk about a game, you're like, all right, what are the friction points? What are things that are annoying that aren't necessarily tied to the core loop? How could they be better? So kind of like finding that little perfect blend of storms. Like I said, there's a lot of answers here because it's just such a large topic. Hopefully I handled it in a concise manner for you. I can like go into more detail, but I know it's a shorter podcast.
Oh, no, you can go into as little or as much detail as you like. I think you answered the question deftly, so thanks for that. I know it was rather meaty. So
it's very meaty.
Chris and I have worn a lot of hats in the industry, but neither of us have worn the hat of designer. So it's always interesting to hear.
We're always happy to be armchair designers, but I think every gamer in the world is. So,
because Tina, I wanted to ask, you know, it might be a somewhat sensitive question, but like, again, as a dad with two kids that are both going into the arts, you know, my daughter is applying for colleges right now and it's all arts programs. My son will do the same. He's 14. You know, it's a new world out there. As a parent that like sees kids so excited right now about doing this, what are some of the challenges and opportunities if you're not the standard cis white male person that's working in the game industry right now? What would be the best ways to prepare people that are bright, young, and excited that don't fit into that very narrow square box?
Yeah, this is a very hard question because it hits really close to home in general, because it's probably already started. For your daughter, it starts really early for women when they're growing up. I think it's first grade. If you break down how many girls versus boys are interested in things like STEM, it's pretty evenly split. And after like first or second grade, it skews so much more STEM for boys.
It's beaten out of girls.
Yeah, it like you have to be strong. Like you have to weather, you have to put up with a lot of things that you shouldn't. Like in the game industry, it's really rare for a woman to last more than 5 years in terms of like wanting to stay in the industry.
Yeah.
Because they get so burnt out, they get so tired. And things are improving, which is the silver lining. Things are improving. People are realizing like, hey, if we have the same people making games, we're gonna have the same games and not have anything new and innovative. But again, that resilience, that being able to stand up for what you believe and having a found family, I think is important. Either people that are coworkers that you know that you can trust and kind of help stand up for you. And obviously you can stand up for yourself, but sometimes your voice gets lost. And
sure,
it can be really unfortunate and it can be really sad to present something in a meeting and then 5 minutes later a guy says the same thing and everyone's like, oh, this is a great idea. I'm like, oh, thanks for repeating the idea that I just had, right? There are so many experiences that I've had, but I think the big one is you have to be resilient and you have to stand up for things. And it's a delicate balance of being forthright but also not being too aggressive. I think that if you haven't seen the Barbie movie,
yeah, I've seen it,
the actress America just going off on what it's like to be a woman in today's society, and also they didn't have a CEO on the Barbie, like I'm like, oh, that hit me so hard in the theaters. And I was like, oh yep,
yeah.
Oh guys, I did appreciate that they called it out. It's like that type of stuff you see all the time.
Speaking of that, again, to the degree that you're comfortable talking about it, I did think it was interesting when Gabe Layden left Machine Zone and Christine Dumont came in.
Yeah.
That is in one of the most, you know, I would imagine bro-y cultures that there is, because it has to be constantly looking at KPIs and driving towards big numbers and stuff like that. And so how did that work with her integration and her ownership of the space? Because my understanding is she was like really respected.
So I wasn't there during the transition period. I came to Machine Zone after that, so I can't tell you kind of the ins and outs. Again, what I would say is that she was very strong and she had a vision and she knew what needed to be done to make things happen.
Sounds like a leader.
Yeah, very much a leader. I think one of the things that can be challenging for new non-cis white guys in the industry is the pushback and kind of the, like, not necessarily hostility, but just like the low level stuff that you have to put up with. And it's like, sometimes you just can't always be liked. And like being comfortable in that space is very difficult. Like presenting these ideas that a lot of people don't like. Like, oh, that's not how things are done. Or like I fought my whole career about on casual games, people would come from, you know, hardcore MMOs and we were doing a guild feature. And they were trying to have like this in-depth guild that would be in an MMO. And at the time, I'm like, our target audience is using Yahoo groups, guys. We don't need like three levels of how the progression could go if people left the guild or whatever. Like, look at what Yahoo groups is doing and see like how we can improve it and integrate it to our game, because that's the experience that they're used to. So pushing what things mean is also very interesting and challenging sometimes.
Some of that seems like it's understanding your end user or player, right? So
it is.
Seems unwise to attempt to force things down players' throats if they're not likely to be receptive to it. But I guess it does happen. Being comfortable with not being liked is something that resonates with me as well as someone who has held leadership positions and also has a desire to be liked. It's sometimes at odds with what you need to do in order to kind of make decisions as a leader. So I can imagine it maybe doubly or more than doubly challenging for a female in that environment.
Yeah, I think that our nature as humans is we want to be liked and we want to do good things for the people that we work with because we care about them. But at the same time, you can't make everyone right? Compromises have to be made, and there are going to be people that are going to be upset at certain things. And it's the moral compass that you have to kind of guide what that means for you.
Yeah, I think also being a better ally is something that we can all learn to do. Even on this podcast, Chris has helped remind me that I have a tendency to talk over people. It's just, and I do that at work. I do that all the time. It's just I'm jubilant, you know, I'm excited and I want to express my ideas. And sometimes I forget that doing that can trample other people's opportunities to talk. And so I actively pull back.
I think it's also a function of the format, right? If you and I were having a conversation, it's a little more conversationally okay or normal to kind of have that overlap, like talking over one another, because you get excited and you feed it off of each other and you're like, but what about that? What about that? And sometimes it doesn't play as well in the podcast environment because it doesn't allow for people's thoughts to be fully developed and out the mouth before you move on to something else. But it's we're getting much better at it, I think. So
yeah,
that's good.
I would say also the medium is very difficult. So Zoom in particularly, if you have like a delay, if you have like someone's video slightly out of sync, you might think that someone is finished when you start to speak and you like can be out of alignment there. So I've definitely noticed that a lot more with remote work.
For sure. I agree 100%. It can... Because you want, yes, you try to bring your normal conversational style to a meeting, and it doesn't take much latency to kind of step all over things, and it can get kind of weird or wonky. Maybe everyone should go back to the walkie-talkie thing. Over.
Yep. Well, so, Katina, in different work environments, there are a lot of things that Chris and I, as cis white males, probably take very much for granted. Right? Is it easy for you to be able to identify who's an ally or how to work with people in the office that are more prone to understand the challenges of not being the majority?
Or appreciate it if
yeah.
you don't understand it. Yeah.
So I will say that for the most part, I've been very fortunate in my career. And I think that it is fortunate working in the game industry because at the end of the day, people really are passionate about making games.
Yeah.
And a lot of them like have this as part of their core. So if you bring up something that they're doing or something that's like hindering this particular goal, they are a little bit more introspective about it and a little bit more willing to listen, I think, than in certain other mediums. I think for me, it's very easy to tell who is an ally. I can also tell who doesn't know what they don't know, so they don't realize certain things that they're doing, kind of like you mentioned, like, I have this, like, I talk over people. I also have this thing as well, so I try to not talk as much so that people can have their voices heard. I think another one that's really hard is a lot of microaggressions, which people don't think about at all. It's just kind of generic. A huge example is if I'm in a meeting and I'm the only woman, then people will be, oh, can you take notes? Like, that is...
Oh, interesting.
That is, like, yikes. Definitely an example of a microaggression.
I'll take one note, F.
So, but, like, for most people, they don't think of it as a microaggression or, like, a gender role or terrible. Anything. So that's what I'm saying. There's a lot of people that don't realize these types of things happen. I think that with a lot of diversity, a lot of, like, companies are really trying to showcase, hey, not everyone processes things like you do. And I think that there's even a step beyond that, which is not gender related, but like neurodivergent. The industry is full of a lot of neurodivergent people, and people communicate very differently, process things very differently, don't understand like this particular aspect of them until they start reading and they're like, oh, this is me. Okay, got it.
Like, no soft skills.
Well, not even not soft skills, right? So, for example, I have some ADHD tendencies, which make it very difficult sometimes for me to focus on things.
Say, watch a movie.
I can't watch a movie, but like listening to music. One thing that I do to focus, because again, the reason I don't listen to podcasts is listening to things I can't learn. So I read the transcript because it gives me something to focus on. So on all my meetings, I typically have closed captions on, so I can double focus on what's going on around. So it's like figuring out how to communicate and coordinate with other people. So it's not just like one thing or another. There's a lot of different nuances, I think.
Yeah. Well, there are also often cultural challenges. I'll be polite and will not name names, but there was someone we all worked with once who came from a different culture and would sometimes say shockingly rude things. And they were very nice. It was a very nice person, but they just didn't understand that certain things you just don't say out here in the West. And so we corrected that, and they wouldn't do it again, and they'd feel very badly, very apologetic, right? That sometimes can be a challenge too. And you have two choices there. You can just assume that the person has really bad beliefs and is a negative person, or you can assume that they just don't know how to communicate properly in a new culture and can fix that.
Well, I would argue that it's best not to assume, and it's better to ask them to clarify, and then you better understand their intent and take it from there.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
Yeah, going back to the empathy thing, like assuming ill intent a lot of times can get you in a place that you didn't want to get to or shouldn't have gotten to. If it had been thought with a little bit more kindness, or like, hey, didn't quite get this, or this is how I perceive this. I think that therapy is a great tool to use in terms of learning how to communicate better, in terms of how to present problems and issues, right? Because it's not trying to assign blame,
right,
but like trying to work through an issue, because there's a lot of very good skills and lessons to learn in that. And you can learn them, you know, outside of therapy, but I think that it's a good tool as well.
Yeah, I think for better or for worse, I would probably argue for worse. We're so focused, and the engines of media are aligned towards outrage and stirring and stoking emotions. So I think it's important to try to compartmentalize that information that you digest and take a different tact when you're dealing with people on an interpersonal level, lest we all be outraged all the time, which is exhausting. So
yeah.
If folks are okay, I'd like to move on to another topic along empathy. Ethan's got a slightly different approach to empathy in games, especially as pertains to his perception of a certain stripe of game developers.
Yeah. So I'll say that in my 24 years...
You're older than 24. Come on.
Sorry.
I'm just kidding.
Working within the industry of games, let me say specifically, right? there are two things that I think I want to be most known for. One was being the producer of Monkey Ball on iPhone. Super proud of that. First game ever to be number one at the App Store. The second, and that was 2008. The second is in 2016, and that was when I made a personal commitment never to work again on a game that would use whaling techniques. I want to be known for that too. These are two things that are very, very important to me in terms of my identity. I'm looking at that last one, and I'm realizing that despite being in a position where I feel very strongly about this, I want to understand people who are comfortable with whaling techniques. I look at empathy and say, how can I empathize with people who are comfortable getting customers, individual customers, to spend $150,000 or more on a single game? When I hear that kind of number, alarm bells go off, and I think this has to be a scam. There's absolutely no way that a game can be worth that much. Not when you have grounding examples like Super Mario Odyssey, which is $60 all in. It doesn't make any sense to me at all. But what I have to realize is that the people often that are typically that are working on these games literally believe that these games are worth $150,000 or more to some players. And that it's just, it's such a foundational difference in an understanding of values that it's a brick wall for me. So I have to, again, and I can only do it through empathy, accept and understand that that is their true belief. And so if they are trying to get a customer to spend that much money, if they're doing it, it's not a scam because they truly believe that that is the actual value that they're imparting. I can't do it. And that's why I committed never to do it, because if I try to do that, I so disbelieve that a game can be worth that much that if I were to try to push that, I would be perpetuating a scam, because I cannot see a game that's a live service game, for instance, offering more than $20 a month in value, right? I simply can't see the $1,000 a month.
Well put. And I would love to, Katina, you have a lot of experience in the free-to-play realm. I have a fair amount myself. I have thoughts, but I would love to hear your thoughts and your perspective. Certainly there are predatory practices. I think it was more of a problem in the early days of kind of free-to-play game development, but I really welcome your perspective on this.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here. And the big thing in terms of the early market free-to-play, I don't think people realize how much someone would want to spend, going to your point, right? I don't think originally developers were like, hey, we're making this game that's $150,000. I think that they created parts of a game and tried to craft an experience where players could pick and choose how much they wanted to spend. So they didn't want to spend that $60, but maybe they wanted to spend $5. And then I think with the rise of how much spend potential was there, you started getting into a lot of the predatory practices. And there's a lot of potential ways to take free-to-play in a positive direction or a negative direction, right? Because at the end of the day, the customers are choosing with their wallets what they find valuable, not necessarily what the game designers find valuable. Because I would argue that some of the people would find value in some of the things, but not others. And there's a lot to be said about just capitalism in general, right? I buy shoes, I buy clothes. I'm not going to buy like the name brand clothes that are so much more expensive, but there are people that find value in that and they spend money on that. So it's really about what resonates with the player. And I think from my side is making sure that if players spend money on the game, they feel that purchase was valuable and contributes positively to their world. Right. I think $150,000 is a lot of money for someone, and it's not going to be everyone's budget. And I don't think that you necessarily have to hunt whales, but there will be people that are naturally more inclined to spend money than others.
That have more money than sense or have more money. There are people out there for whom $150,000 is nothing, and they won't think twice about spending that amount of money. My eyes cross when I think about that personally. But you have to consider the millions and millions of people out there who are playing games and the trillions and trillions of dollars that are out there and in different people's pockets in different sizes.
So with that in mind, I think another important issue, though, and I hope as an industry we get to this point where companies start becoming a lot more comfortable with transparency. So if you go into a Ferrari dealership, they're going to tell you up front that their top of the line Ferrari for 2025 is more than $500,000, right? They're going to tell you that right at the start, right? It's easy to look up. It's like, you know, it's something that is a part of the discussions. With games, it's always play free now. And when there are situations where the actual upper end of spending comes up in a story, there was a case where Transformers Earth Wars, one of the guys distributing the game in China for Space Ape said they had $150,000 spenders, right? Similar stories have popped up for Genshin Impact, for Game of War, for Mass Effect 3, right? So when these things pop up, almost without exception, unilaterally, the response from readers is shock and disgust, right? And a lot of that's because the model is hidden by the people that are using the model. And what I would love is for companies to say, you know what? This game, we think, for top spenders is worth $150,000. And we're going to be completely upfront with you about that. You may not spend that much. You don't have to. But if you want to come in and see how high spenders peacock against each other, you get a chance to do that. And we are so full-throated in our defense of the value that we provide, that we're more than comfortable to tell you what the high end is. But the fact that they hide it, they don't simply say, we're not going to talk about the high end spenders, but they're covering the cost of things the entire way through with premium currency bundles instead of just straight USD purchases for digital items, with weird cost conversions for USD to these strange proprietary currencies, with loot boxes. It feels like it's tons of obfuscation and that there is this divide between what players understand and what the publishers understand, and no desire to make it as clear as possible for players to have an informed purchase position.
On that note, there's many different things. A, I think that car dealerships is a bad choice because
yet another bunch of stuff to unpack.
Yeah, so car dealerships are a bad choice because a lot of times they do hide the price of things, right? That is kind of their thing of trying to negotiate a car dealership down. But regardless of that, there are a lot of other types of games. So like Magic the Gathering, as an example, has, you could theoretically spend so much money on those and people will sell cards at a particular amount, but that's been around for ages and it kind of has similar notes to it, right? I also think that for the top spend, it's a little bit challenging because a lot of free-to-play games are a concept of I can spend money or I can spend my time. And a lot of the speed-ups, for example, on timers are a decent source of revenue for certain companies. So they could not even begin to calculate that amount, right? It's like if you skipped every timer, like this particular ban versus if you wait this in game, it's going to be a lot different. There's also like gacha boxes, like you mentioned, that some games do. There's also cosmetics. There's a lot of different ways that you could spend money that you don't have to. And calculating that true cost is going to be difficult. I do think it would be great to be transparent about like spend and the conversions and having a standardization there. But I think it makes it more difficult to price things because if you're pricing them in just USD, then you might have problems like, hey, this thing is not going to be worth a dollar. But if we're doing a purchase and we need to make it comparable, and that's kind of where that conversion of premium currency comes from.
It's also a lot easier to balance a system and an economy when you have various currencies that aren't floated to the dollar. And you're also giving a lot of that currency away, or you're earning it through things that you're doing in the game, either through time or through gameplay. So there's a lot of variables that go into the economy of a game, and not all of it is in the name of obfuscation. A lot of it is because games are hard to build and design, and currencies make it a lot easier to balance things, so you can kind of better control the sinks and the faucets.
So with that, first of all, Katina, when you're saying it's hard to calculate, I understand what you're saying, but I still think it would be valuable for people to know, for instance, the average spend of the top 0.15% of the spenders in a game, right? That allows you to know how deep the pool is, right? This is particularly important if the game has any kind of pay-to-win elements. Like, and to use that analogy, like if I'm in a pool and I've been swimming around in a 4-foot pool, right, where the depth allows me to stand when I need to and take a breath, if suddenly I'm finding myself swimming in a 1,000-foot pool, right? I can drown. If I'm not being given the context of like how deep the pool is, that's not reasonable. I think you need to be able to make sure people know that it's hundreds of thousands of dollars or more that they can potentially spend in the game, and that's by design.
How are you going to drown though?
Well, think about it. Like the games are designed to habituate, right? They want you to play every day. You get more and more invested. You get your friends. You suddenly realize that there's kind of a mounting cost for keeping up. You don't know as a player where the pinch points are in the game that's explicitly designing you to get you to spend more. Your guild members, well, you often don't know until weeks in.
I think you discount player savviness and their ability to kind of sniff out bad behaviors. I'm not saying there aren't dark patterns, but I think that the average player of free-to-play games is fairly savvy and has an idea about what value they're going to get out of it pretty early on. I think if you are a game designer, game maker today, and you are just looking to make a quick buck, it is going to be very difficult to do because there are so many other options out there. And yes, there are, I think that a lot of work can be done around transparency, especially as regards to kids and to maybe people who have a tendency towards addiction, and maybe that's the wrong term, but loot boxes there are gambling-esque type mechanics in games today that maybe should be looked at a little more critically.
Yeah.
But I'm very loath to take a very broad brush and say free-to-play bad, which I feel a lot of what you say feels like when you talk about it.
So this is why I was saying that it can be valuable to understand that a lot of people in games, if you ask them, can a game give a player $150,000 in value? If they say yes, that's okay. That's a reasonable thing that they've come to a conclusion that happens to be very different than my conclusion. But when,
value by whose standard?
Well, are they comfortable with the idea that their game is able to offer, that it's even a feasible concept that it can offer $150,000 in value? And there are some players who feel that. But there's a divide, I think, and it's important for players who might not agree that a game can offer that much to know that some games are set up, designed to enable that, right? I think I would love it if all players understood that free-to-play means whaling, means people spending thousands of dollars on the low end to be at the top of the chain in these games. I want everyone to know what whaling is. That's my thing. I want to make sure that there's no one who doesn't understand that these free-to-play games are costing some people thousands of dollars.
I'm going to jump in here. I think that most people do realize that the thing that can happen. And I think players are much smarter now, right? Like the mobile market has matured and they understand that this is a possibility. And I think that games are doing a better job of making sure that people that have like spin patterns and strategies involved in this are grouped closer together, right? Because a game isn't going to be fun. People aren't going to come back if you're pairing like the person that spends $5 with the person that spends like $150,000 as an example. But it's not just about spend in these games either, right? A lot of them still have skill levels. They have a lot of different strategies, and there are ways that you can be more successful, and the best types of games are more successful when players that are free to play can also be competitive with people that are spending a lot of money in the game. Because again, it's like what they find valuable and like what they find interesting to continue to play. Because if I'm playing a mobile game, I can tell you that there's not going to be anything that I feel is worth $150,000 to play. Right?
Same.
But there are going to be people that are like, yes, this is valuable. Skip all these timers. It's valuable to get this particular thing because of X reasons, right? And I think as a game designer in free-to-play, you have to understand like how your players consume your content and what they find valuable, right? Because if they don't find something valuable, they won't spend on it. Right. So that's like having that value proposition to what makes sense to them. And I get that that's not you and that's not everyone, but.
No, and I understand. And one thing that does help me is when I talk to friends and people I respect, like both of you, and understand that we feel.
Thanks.
Well, no, I'm just saying that
I'm kidding.
It helps me understand that, you know, there are people that I can relate with on so many things that even if this isn't one of those things, it's you know, still something that people that I respect feel differently than me on. Right. And so it's not like these are just people that I have no connection to that just I see as this kind of amorphous negative.
I have a little bit of a sidebar. Do you find it to be kind of ironic that the fact that most people have no problems with the free-to-play model are often the same people who scream bloody murder when publishers try to ratchet up the price of a game from like $50 to $60 or $60 to $70?
That doesn't surprise me, but I would say that those same people do tend to get pretty loud when the stories pop up that, you know, Diablo Immortal lets you spend $250,000 to spec out your character. Those same people get pretty pissed when they hear about that. And again, that's where I really wish that Blizzard would just say, damn right, $250,000, totally worth it. We support this. We're behind this. We're open about it. And that is what I want us to get to. I think that all of what you're saying still fits within the context of publishers can and should be more open about what whaling is and how much it is, because if they stand behind it, there should be no reason for them to back away when these stories pop up and make clear that people will spend $250,000 on a build. Like, why can't they just say, yep, it's worth it, totally worth it, and we support this? And that never happens. Like, if they believe in the model, why don't they tell their players about the whole model and how it works?
Because most people don't really care or need to know what the model is. They understand free-to-play. They understand that there's currencies. And I don't think they care that most people are not going to feel like they're being tricked into spending, oops, I spent $150,000, because the concept of spending $150,000 on a game is ludicrous to them, to the vast majority of gamers. The vast majority of people playing free-to-play never spend a dime. So I think a lot of the horror that people see when they hear about these games, could it be more the horror that someone is spending that amount on a game as opposed to the publisher's bad because they're trying to extract this from someone? Like, how many studies have been done on these people who are whales and they're happy to be whales versus people who have buyer's remorse?
So those players are also owning it exactly the same way I want publishers to. Like, the players, when you get those cases, there are ones that express remorse. There are plenty of those stories too. But the players that say, yeah, I spent $16,000 and I was happy with it, right? Mm-hmm. I want publishers to say, damn right, our customers spent $250,000 on it and it's worth it. And here's why. Like, if you're going to charge that much, man up and say, this is why. You know, this is worth it. We're not going to back down, because I think one of the things that erodes trust is that when these things come up and when these stories pop into the media and there's a lot of disgust and shock and anger, they don't stand up for themselves. So, like, how can you trust that even they believe that it's worth these exorbitant prices?
One thing that I do want to chime in is that a lot of companies that make these types of games do intend them to be more long-lived. So what they're trying to do is have people play through the content, but if someone wants to skip through to get to the end, that is also available, right? So this $500,000, I'm not as familiar with this particular thing, could be like, hey, we wanted this to last 6 months, and someone spent instead of spending 6 months grinding on this.
Yeah.
So it can be a little different in terms of that as well.
I understand. But even talking to the both of you, I haven't heard a reasonable pushback on why a company that is completely comfortable with and proud of the value that they provide at $150,000, $250,000, for them to stand up and say, yes, that is what it is, and it's worth it. Like, if it's not worth it, then I understand them not talking about it. But if it is worth it, if they believe that it's worth that much, why don't they say so?
So can you name another industry where companies crow how much money their customers spend on their products?
Can you name an industry where all of the prices are obfuscated? all the time. Like, you know, if you have somebody who's buying a fancy car, like, yeah, you may have to haggle at the end, but at the start, you know, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars to begin with. If you're going to a fancy restaurant, you see right there on the menu that your Wagyu beef at Alexander's Steakhouse is $200, right? If you're a golfer and you're going and buying all of your golfing clubs and, you know, you're signing up for a membership at the Medina Golf Club and stuff like that, the pricing is apparent. Upfront pricing, transparency, that's really important. How deep is the pool? How expensive can this hobby be that I'm getting into? That should not be a secret.
So what I would say very quickly is that the games are like a menu. They tell you how much these particular things are. Like, Alexander Steakhouse isn't going to tell you how much it would cost to buy the entire restaurant out for that evening, right? Like, a lot of art is also subjective. There's also like a lot of auctioning on various things, not even talking about in the gaming industry, right? There are differences. And I think the thing that it sounds like you're struggling with is that companies aren't like, yes, we want people to spend $100 million and this is how much it costs. Because, like, at the end of the day, they're not making the game for them. They're making it for the player. And the player is choosing how valuable that is. So, like, yes, players do find value in this game, and they do obviously spend money on it. And we support them doing that. We also support people not spending. Right? So it is, like, again, going back to that player and that experience that they want.
So how can we help protect players who don't believe that the game is worth that much from getting whaled? Like, because again, there are a lot of nudges, a lot of dark patterns, we all have to admit that are being used to push people towards higher and higher levels of spending. So how do we make sure they're informed?
Can you define getting whaled, what that means to you?
Yeah, sliding down the funnel in a way where you're spending in a way that gets you to these tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So you wake up one day and you realize you've spent $10,000 on this game. Is that what you mean?
There was a case not long ago where there was someone who asked to get their data back from a company. I'm not going to name names, but that thought they had spent like a fraction of what they actually had. There's cases of people who come home and get used to playing certain games where you can get cool hats and stuff. And, you know, if it's loot box driven, we'll spend and spend and spend and just simply lose track of what it is until they get the big bill at the end, right? We're talking about habituation, cost obfuscation, and uncapped spending. And these are really dangerous things that I think without any regulation, we want people to know what's going on, what the high end of spending is, and how they can keep themselves safe from getting themselves into a spending cycle that they were not anticipating.
Keep themselves safe. So protect them from themselves.
To give them enough information to make informed purchase decisions.
Even though they're not making very well-informed purchase decisions.
Because everything's obfuscated and there's no idea of how high the spending intent is, what the total potential cost is, and they're spending into a black box. They don't know how deep this well is designed to pull them. Yeah, I would love to be in a position where, again, people understand the heavy spending potential. And if that's not what they want to do, but they're still having a fun time with the game, what are the things that they can do to keep themselves from getting into a position where they're overspending?
I think that at the end of the day, you have to let people do things that they want to do, right? I understand you wanting to protect people and wanting to let people know about this thing. I think that a lot of people do understand how free-to-play works. They understand like the spend potential, but you can't hold someone's hand for their whole life, right? You have to let them either learn, you have to let them with that understanding, like make their own decisions, because like there are so many industries that you could also say this about, right? Like there's so many things out there where this is also applicable. And I won't get into some of them because some of them are kind of controversial and like various points of politics, but free will exists. And like you can try and like educate people as much as possible, but at the end of the day, it's up to them to choose how they do their life, right?
Okay.
I agree with Katina, but I also agree, Ethan, that there could be better transparency so that people can make better informed choices. Although it sounds to me the use case you're most concerned with are people that maybe have self-control issues and there's only so much messaging that you can do to curb that. That there's going to need to be some sort of internal modulator to prevent them from going overboard. I don't think the answer is full stop to prevent games from charging for players from spending the money. I think even if you put this information in front of people, you're still going to have people that wonder why their bank, you know, they can't pay rent because they spent too much money in this game. You could look at the betting apps. They're similar, and maybe this is a conversation diversion that you would welcome since it is kind of gambling. I won't ever disagree with you that some of these patterns kind of closely mirror gambling in some respects, especially, you know, the term whales come from gambling. I think everyone knows that. So I guess TLDR, I do think more transparency would be helpful, but ultimately it comes down to the consumer making a decision.
Yep.
This definitely resonates with what I was trying to say as well, Chris. I have seen parental controls be more expanded. And I think that having potential caps in like games where you can set that like, hey, I only want to spend $100 a month in this game. Like, I think that there are ways to make it more healthy. I don't think that just like messaging it or letting people know is going to actually stop the behavior. Like, there needs to be something additional, right, to help them follow through with that.
So totally agree. Unfortunately, that usually happens only when regulatory bodies come in. So the FCC recently, it was just announced that Genshin Impact now requires parental consent for loot box purchases under 16, right? I'd prefer 18, but it's still a huge step. It's great, right?
Definitely.
I love that that happened. I think that that's better for everyone. I also think that you can have steps like having a one button press to see what your cumulative spend has been. So with all the confusion of these different currencies, if I can at any moment I want to just spot check and see how much have I really spent on this thing so far, I can do that, right? I personally would love it if they were, and again, this would only happen through regulation, but if they were required to disclose the top 0.15% of spenders, like what their cumulative spend is, their LTV, I'd love that. Won't happen, but I think it would be good. I think, again, the big thing is just transparency, and the closer we can get to transparency, the better off we are. I know people will want to continue to play these games. I don't think we should take these games away from people who love them, right? That's never what I have been trying to articulate. But I just wish I could trust the publishers more, because there's a lot of asymmetry of information. And that didn't used to be the case. It used to be a much simpler value proposition where a developer said, this is worth $60. I said, yep, that's worth $60. I give them the money and business is done and both sides are happy. Now it feels like this perpetual tug of war where the player might feel like something's worth maybe $20 a month. The developer firmly and earnestly believes that it's worth $150,000 or thousands of dollars a month. And there's a tug of war because they don't agree. So there's constantly this push to spend, not because the developers are trying to gouge them, but because the developers have a different belief in terms of what the value of their stuff is than many of their players, right? And that tension I dislike immensely. So if I can ask one last question on this, okay? So I think the thing that is frustrating to me is that, again, when these stories pop up and it's made clear that people are spending tons of money, My impression might be wrong, but my impression is that the actual publishers, when they see all of the shock and disgust, is one of indifference. Is that fair? Do you think that when they see all of this anger and frustration that comes from people actually understanding what these models are, that they just dismiss it, that they don't internalize and say, wow, lots of people think this is ugly, that this is a really nasty model? Like, and even if they're going to proceed, do they process and integrate that processing into their understanding of the work and how people perceive it?
So I can't speak for any particular company. I think that there could be a lot of factors in play here. We've talked about at the very beginning how the vocal minority is very loud. Right. So that happens quite frequently in all of these forums. Gamers can be very toxic. There are a lot of very big instances where, you know, EA was voted the worst game in America, I think, for like Mass Effect 3, when Bank of America just foreclosed on like millions of people's homes, or I can't remember the amount. But the fact that because they had loot boxes in like Mass Effect 3, EA became the worst company in America voted for versus someone that foreclosed on a lot of people's homes. Like, it can be very out of proportion. And I think that it can be hard to really know what people are thinking because of it. So there is a little bit of that, like, is this actually what people think, or is this what the minority is saying to think? So there's aspects of that, I think, at play.
So it's less, we know this is kind of ugly, but it's making a lot of money and our shareholders expect it, and more, this might be the vocal minority, and so it's fine, and we'll let the numbers decide.
So, I mean, it could be both, right? A lot of companies are publicly traded, and they are trying to make more money because the issue is, like, $60 isn't a lot for a AAA game anymore, right? Those games cost so much money to make, and they are really depending on those number of sales. But $60, the game prices haven't really changed in decades, but the costs have continued to go up. Like, inflation's a thing, just our economy works, right? I think that they did I saw an article about price points, and games should be like $120 to $200.
Yeah.
Account for inflation.
If adjusted for inflation.
Just
for
inflation, sure. Yeah. That's not like how much it's taken to make them as well. And they're not, right? Yeah. So they're trying to figure out, like, seeing the success of mobile free-to-play, they're like, oh, how can we extend the runway? How can we extend these games and also unlock more spend? Which, you know, that's kind of what you were a little bit upset about in terms of, like, the strategies around those. And I do think the transparency is very important, and, like, making sure players feel value in that.
Agree. I think we can all agree more transparency would be better for the industry and for consumers. But developers, publishers do need to find new ways to win those bucks from the consumers. And I think those who do it well can express a good value proposition, and people generally feel good when they spend money in the game. And the people that have buyer's remorse or feel ripped off when they play a game, they'll stop playing the game. So the examples of people spending $150,000 and feeling bad about it are, I would argue, minuscule. And certainly they sell clicks and are great headlines, but I think they're the vast, vast minority.
A lot of game designers don't want people to spend that much. Like, obviously, it's a business, right? And at the end of the day, you have to do stuff business related, that you have to choose where your morals are and, like, what you're acceptable with, and, like, trying to make that as fair and valuable to the player. But at the end of the day, it's like, it's not good for people to spend more than they want to spend, because they don't want to come back. So you have to be very careful and mindful of, like, when you're introducing new spend things, like, what makes sense? Like, is it too much? So, like, there are a lot of thoughts in terms of that. And it's, like, different between, like, casual and free to play. But those are definitely very important things to think about when you're designing for these games. I think in terms of this subject, it's one that it's very close to my heart, because as a game designer, the thing that I typically have to balance, you know, is, like, the free-to-play question. How can I provide a fair value proposition to the players? Because we can't give everything away for free, because then we would go out of business and not be able to keep the game open for people that love it, but also provide a safe community, because, like, there's a lot of toxicity in games. So, like, how can we make everyone feel valued and heard in a healthy way that isn't toxic? And then also have those diverse voices be able to express themselves. So those are, like, things that I look for when I'm designing games, and how I can help push those forward. And that's just kind of, like, how I operate as a designer.
That's great. Well summarized. It was a really good conversation. Got a little feisty, which I like. always good to bump up against Ethan. And really appreciate you taking the time to join us, Ethan. Any closing quick thoughts?
Just, you know, it's really great to talk to people and have a respectful conversation about this challenging topic that really know what they're talking about. So it's not theoretical. It's not just talking to people that play games but don't have a context for how they're made. And appreciate you indulging me on this, because it really does help me better understand other perspectives. And as I said, empathy can be difficult, but it's easier when I'm talking to people who are experts that are willing to hear out my concerns.
Awesome. Yeah. Likewise, enjoy the conversation. I think differing perspectives are good, and it's good to talk about them and have the conversation. And hopefully folks listening also enjoyed. If you have anything you want to contribute, let us know. And let's all be a little nicer to everyone out there.
Yeah. All just a little bit of kindness goes a long way, I think.
Sure does.
All right. Thanks for having me here. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening.